Om Bharataya Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitam Ritavarashinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvam Anusantadhami Bhagavad Gita Bhavadveshinim.
So we're on verse 47. Just looking for a book or book of you. Kristen, give this to the book. And there's one up here for you. You see that Gita up there? It's right up there in the gray. By that little painting? Yeah. So we're on chapter 18, verse 47. That's good.
Thanks.
That's all Sanskrit. If you want Sanskrit, that's fine. Oh, no, that's Swamiji's.
Oh, yeah.
This is the
same.
That's the Swamiji's
one. Yeah, that's Swamiji's one.
I use this one.
Okay. Go way in the back. way in the back. Yeah. I think we're on verse 47. Shreyan Sudharmo Vigunaha Shreyan Sudharmo Vigunaha Paradharmat Svanushtitat Paradharmat Svanushtitat Swabhava Niyatam Karma Swabhava Niyatam Karma Kurvanapnoti Kilbisham Kurvanapnoti Kilbisham Shreyan Swadharmaha Vigunaha Paradharmat Swanushtitat Swabhava Niyatam Karma Kurvan Na Apnoti Kilbisham. All of these last several verses are dealing with really the kind of a viveka between the ashramas. I mean the ashramas, the varanas. That you may be born as a brahmana or a kshatriya or a vaishya or a shudra, you know. Being primarily, if you would say, if the caste system is working, if the varna system is working, if because of the karmas that I'd accrued in my last birth to take me into this birth were primarily sattvic, if my buddhi or if the whole antakarana was primarily sattvic, I would probably be born as a brahmana, because those type of karmas that a brahmana is asked to do would be suitable to my nature, to my personality as a person. If because of my prior karmas I was more rajasic, sattva and rajas, with some sattva, I might be born as a kshatriya, because the duties of the kshatriya, the warrior class or the political class of people, warrior class of people, military class of people, might be more in harmony with my swabhava, with my nature. Vaishya would be more rajas with tamas. And then I would be maybe very interested in agriculture or in commerce or being a merchant of sorts. That's what would suit me, my personality. Or if I was born as a shudra, which is primarily tamas, you know, with some rajas secondarily, then I might be the happiest serving people. People tell me what to do. These are your job to do this. That's kind of the blue collar or maybe in secretarial or liking to be a support system, be part of the support system. And that's what I'm most comfortable with. I can do an 8-to-5 and I can work very hard, do the duties that are taught to me and fulfill those obligations and be helpful to the people who have hired me in that way. So this whole Varna system is just looking at the types of people that we have and dividing them into broad categories. And if the Varna system were still functioning now, you know, maybe maybe we would be born into labeled groups of people, right? If I was primarily Satrika, I would be born into people who were labeled as Brahmanas. These labels we don't have anymore, right? However, you are born into the group of people, or the Varna, the caste of people that we're not labeling in the same way, but that the caste of people in which who you are in terms of a jiva, in terms of your prior karmas, what is the Varna, what is the group of people where you can express yourself most easily? See what I mean? So even though we're not labeling the world in this way, nevertheless, if you're looking at, as a Hindu will do, just accepting that reincarnation, why would you be born into one family as opposed to another? Well, according to the laws of karma, you will be born into the family, into the world at the time, in the situation that is best suited for you, to the point that you can say, this is where I belong. What I have been, where I am, the life that I've been born into, is the life in which I fit the most perfectly. Look at it, if you look at this whole universe as an infinite display of cause and effect, of karma, of infinite intelligence as Ishvara, then every place where, everywhere you find a person with a certain occupation, that particular person is the one who's suited to be there, not you. This person is suited to be there. You are suited to be where you are. You are suited to be where you are. So your prarabdha, the idea is this, the prarabdha, the karmas that caused you to take this birth, are your karmas. And so this life that you've been given is your life. Nobody else's. It's yours and you have a right to it. And we can say that. Sometimes in India we won't say right. You know, it would be, we say more like, this is your life, and you have a duty to, you as an individual should do your duties, you know, do what is being asked of you in this life that has been given to you. You know? Another way of saying it, more Western way maybe, is I have a right to be here because this is my karma. I belong here. This is it that way too, you know. Swamiji sometimes says, in line with this, the prarabdha karma, you will get what is yours, and you won't get what isn't. Very simple. Very relaxing. What is mine will come my way, and what isn't mine, I won't get. So be here in this prarabdha that belongs to you, and in this prarabdha, do what is asked of you. So even though the caste system is not really functioning that well anymore, nevertheless, if the caste system itself is broken down in terms of labeling, active working labels, I think that is not working as well. But perhaps the caste system itself, in terms of the natural groupings of people, is still functioning because we still have a military, you know. And we still have commerce, we still have agriculture, we still have scholars and priests, you know. These categories are there, these broad categories are there. And so why would you be born into one category or find yourself attracted to one category more than another? Well, it may have to do with the combination of prakriti, the combination of the gunas, which are really manifesting in terms of the upadhi which you're working with in this life. So that is the idea. So with that, that's what's been talked about in now like these last 10 verses or so. So now what he says is Shreyan Swadharmaha Vigunaha. One's own dharma means one's own karmas the duties that are yours. This is another thing to really understand what we're when we talk about the prarabdha karma. We think of it instead of you creating your life, because you can actually look at it either way. Instead of looking at it as you creating your life, you can also say, I am responding to my life that is here. I am acting upon the life that is here. Right? I'm not, if I say I'm creating, it's as though there was nothing here and I'm creating it. So I think it's actually more accurate to say that I am responding to the life that is here. And if I say that, then I can say, let me respond to the life that is here according to my own dharma. This is my swadharma. This life is my swadharma. Swadharma means my own. I have certain duties that are being asked of me in this situation. So here it says, your own swadharma, the own duties and karma, your own duties and karmas, even the karmas that are asked for you to do, that are there for you to fulfill in any given moment, those dharmas are preferable, are better, shreyam, far better. Shreyas is a strong word. They are far better, shreyam swadharmaha, vigunaha, even if they're done improperly. They're your duties, you're doing your best, but maybe you're not doing them that well, right? Nevertheless, they are still superior, far better than the Pada Dharma Swanushti taught, the dharmas of another, Pada, the dharmas or the karmas of somebody else, even if they're done really well. Swa Anushti taught means you're doing su. Su means well. You're performing them very well. But they're not yours. That's not what's being asked of you. In fact, you must have left what's being asked of you to go over and do what Joe Blow's doing over here and say you do it really well. You know? I had this, I don't think this is maybe not quite the perfect example, but it is really interesting. I had a couple of very good friends, one young woman and her husband. This is when we were in our 20s. And her husband was an artist, and he used to paint big canvases, and had some small name for himself, and he used to paint music. So he would go to some jazz musicians, and he knew all of these musicians, well known jazz musicians, and as they would perform their music, he would actually paint the music. And so he became well known for this, and his paintings were really amazing, actually. They were very interesting. But then, and so many of these musicians were good friends of his, and he used to hang out. They would come over to my friend's house all the time, and I even got to know some of them. And so he got it in his mind that he wanted to be a jazz musician also. Yeah. And so what he did was he started practicing. And he practiced and practiced all the time, maybe 8 hours a day, all the time he practiced. And he got better and better and better, you know, until he himself was a jazz musician, okay? He could do it. It was one of these, what are those big, like those like clarinets that look like a big...
Saxophone.
They look like a saxophone, yeah. So that's what he played. And he got to be really... really, really good. But none of the musicians would accept him. He wasn't supposed to be a musician. They didn't accept him. Yeah, it was very painful for him. But to them, he was an artist. He was a painter. He wasn't a musician. And so he wanted to change from being an artist to a musician, and they wouldn't accept it. It's just, and anyway, this just reminded me of that. And it was painful for him. He never fit into the musician world. He was very well, fit in very well to the world of the artist. But he was never fit in and was accepted into that world of the musician. I lost track of those people many after a few years. So I don't know how the story ended, but that's how it was when I was growing up with these people. And I kind of feel like it is kind of like that. Like when you're in your own dharma, you're living out in your own dharma. That's where you fit in, because that is exactly where you belong in the creation. But the creation, because you have free will, there's some wiggle room. And you can get out into other people's dharma that you're attracted to, that you are interested in, but you're really not allowed to join it. You can try, but those doors are more or less closed to you, in a sense, because you're outside of your own dharma. And so it, in fact, is not comfortable. You're not fitting there. Now, another way you may have had this experience for yourself, say you're looking at within your own life, the own flow of your own life, and you start going out, getting kind of off track from your own life, right? So you're getting off track, a little bit more off track, and things are not feeling quite right, you know? And you get to a point where it's as though you hit the edge of your own prarabdha. You hit the edge of it, the wall of it, and it won't let you go any further. And you feel very uncomfortable out there, and it pushes you back. It pushes you back in line into where you actually fit in. So I'm just wondering, these are actual experiences. I don't know, you would have to put these experiences in your own words, because I think all of us, you know, especially when you're growing up, you're always trying out other costumes in a way, and what the Joneses are doing, you know, but it doesn't fit. It's not really who you are, you know. I noticed when I was growing up, I used to want to fit in to what this group was doing and that group was doing, because I liked the people. And so I would fake it and pretend like I was one of them, you know. I did that in drama. I did that in art and in being a potter, you know, this kind of stuff. I was doing all these things. And everybody else, I knew it. They knew it was their life. They were totally in it. And they're committed to it. And that's who they were. That was their Swadharma. And they were very clear on it. There was no conflict. And I was feeling, would be looking all around and realizing that they thought I was like them, and that that's who I was too. But I was the only one who really knew that that's not where I belonged. And I would have liked to belong too. I would have really liked to. But I knew very clearly that that wasn't me. And I felt like they didn't know that. I was the only, and I don't think they did know that, but I knew it, and it was kind of very awkward, you know, trying to be one of them when I knew that I wasn't. Of course, I didn't know what I was either, so I was kind of lost, you know. But I think growing up, we had these types of experiences, partially because the society is no longer so structured. When the society was structured, very like in India, society very structured, you are born into your dharma, and that's what's expected of you. You don't have so much sway at all. Your duties are there, and they're very well defined, because you're already categorized as a brahmana or a kshatriya, and your parents are kshatriyas, and they've passed on these duties for generations to generations to generations, so the child knows what they're supposed to do, and they don't question it. But for us, it's really, really not like that. And so it's kind of a trial and an error type of thing here. So here, they're saying, so staying in your own Swadharma is much more comfortable, much more natural, far superior to trying to fit into somebody else's dharma, even if you do it very well. So he says, swabhava niyatam karma kurvan, doing the karma which is natural to you, which is enjoined. Niyata means enjoined by your own swabhava, by your own nature. Right, verse 47. What swabhava niyatam karma kurvan, doing these karmas which are enjoined by your own nature, by your own prarabdha karma, doing that apnoti, says apnoti, na apnoti kilbisham. One is not one. How do you say it? There is no fault. One obtains no fault. There's no papa in that. There's no tension in that. There's nothing wrong in that. You know? So it doesn't matter. The idea also is this, is that karma is karma. There are many, many different karmas that make up this world. Many, many, many diverse duties that need to be performed in this world. All of these duties, you know, none of them liberate you. This is the idea. None of these duties liberate you. None of these karmas liberate you. Because all of them are karma. They all exist within time and space. They all produce a result which is time-bound. That time-bound result can be a punya. It can be very happy. Very give a lot of grace. Or it can be a papa. Or it can be neutral. Yeah. But whatever it is, it's time-bound. And that is exactly the problem that all human beings find themselves in, is that the fruits of all of your actions, no matter how hard you work, no matter how good of a job you do, they're still golden chains, which is a statement, an image that they use. They're still golden chains because the fruit of all of your action is time-bound, comes to an end. They don't give moksha. And so the idea here now, what Krishna is working up to, is because karma, whatever karma it is, whether it produces punya or papa, whether it's your swadharma or somebody else's, it's natural to you or it really belongs to another person, none of them are going to be able to give you what you're seeking. Right? Because whatever they give is going to just be time-bound. The Buddha, in fact, calls these time-bound results, all of them, even the punya, the golden chains, the punya, the very happy results, the punya, as just dukkha yonis. They're just wombs for dukkha. Why? Because it's very sad. It's a sad thing when a very happy occurrence comes to an end. We don't want the blessings in our life to come to an end. Right? So the things that are most meaningful to us, that give us the most joy, things that we've worked for, you know, all of those things that give us shanti also come to an end. The Buddha will say, well, there's really nothing but dukkha here. Four Noble Truths, the first one is dukkha. It's just one word. Dukkha. And the second Noble Truth goes, dukkha samudaya. Dukkha samudaya means, first, dukkha is there, sorrow, suffering is there, and there's a cause for it. And one of the causes, he has several different causes, one of the major causes is that it's anicca. The world is anicca. Anicca means it's subject to continual change. It's temporal. Everything is bound by time. And so no matter what it is that you're seeking, no matter what experiences that you're having, all of those experiences are anicca. And that itself causes suffering. But he goes on, it's Four Noble Truths are really interesting. I'm not going to get into it right now. But anyway. So doing your own, the idea is this, doing your own karma, which has been enjoined by you, for you, for your prarabdha karmas, doing those karmas, one, there is no fault. One obtains no fault. But then, so it goes on to say, let's do this next verse. Sahajam karma kaunteya, sahajam karma kaunteya, sadosham api natyajet, sadosham api natyajet, sarvaram bahidoshena dhumena agnir ivavritaha
Dhume nagnirivavrataha sahajam karma kaunteya sa dosham api natyajet sarva arambaha hi doshena dhumena agnihi eva avrataha. So he says, He Kaunteya, Kaunteya is a name for Arjuna, the son of Kunti, his mother. He Kaunteya, one should not abandon or give up sahajam karma, those karmas which are natural to you, the karmas which really are there as part of your prarabdha karma, the karmas that you find, the very karmas, the actions that are being asked of you in your life situation as your life goes on unfolding. Those are the karmas those are your karmas, right? Those karmas, so he's talking to Arjuna, Arjuna wants to run away. He wants to run away to the forest and become a sannyasi and leave his duties now, which are really to fight this war. He's a kshatriya and he's one of the major princes of the Kshatriya clan, of the Pandavas. He's thinking, no, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. I want to go and be a sannyasi. I think that would be a lot better for me. The whole Bhagavad Gita says, yes, is Krishna saying, no, what's better for you is to stay here and do the Dharma, do the karmas that are being asked for you, asked of you. So this is interesting. He says, it is better to do those karmas which are sahajam, natural to you. They're meant for you, they're natural to you. Sadosham api. Even though they are defective, even though they have their doshas, even though they have their defects, you should not abandon them. Because he says, sarva arambaha, all beginnings. Aramba means a beginning. All beginnings, which means all karmas, every single karma begins, right? That's the one thing about karma. It has a beginning, it has an end, right? So all beginnings, sarva arambaha, he says, all of them are with dosha. All of them have dosha. They're all covered with defects, he says. And he gives an example. Just like smoke, he says, just like fire, agnihi eva, just like Agni, just like fire, Avrataha, it's covered with smoke. Right? Smoke's like a dosha. Here the fire is burning, burning brightly, but then all of the smoke is coming in. And they're using, you know, in a ritual, when they do a ritual, they try to have, this is in India, they try to have a ritual, they're lighting the ritual fire, and it should be hot. The coal should be hot, and the fire should be clear, you know, clear without smoke. So you have this pure fire burning. And then, you know, you offer some ghee. Ghee is good because ghee is also hot. So it's a clear burning fire. And then you offer some yogurt, some curd. And now all of a sudden, it's not clear. Right? But the yogurt still has to, the curd still has to be offered. And milk is offered, you know. And all different kinds of things are offering that are creating tremendous amounts of smoke. So... So now, the pujari, the one who's performed, and the priests who are performing the ritual, right? That ritual itself creates tremendous punya, you know, and they're doing it, the ritual, properly, you know. And what they're doing is what they're supposed to be doing. That's their duty, is to do these rituals. So they're doing these rituals, and they're doing it properly. But as they do it, so much smoke is coming, you know. And then they have to endure all of that smoke. And so, even in the Bhagavad Gita, they talk about this, about the nature of karma itself as in a ritual, you know, the nature of karma as in a ritual, where it's so much work and there's so much hardship involved in it because you're being filled with smoke, 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 smoke. I've sat in these rituals sometimes for 2 or 3 hours. And I have so much shraddha in those particular rituals. Like when I was 60, I had one done, and recently I sat through a ritual, you know. And you have so much Shraddha in the ritual, and yet there's so much smoke that you can't see, you can't open your eyes, and you can barely breathe. But everybody still stays. They still stay, and for the 2 hours or so that it takes, they still stay and do that entire ritual. And then when you're done with the ritual, you are covered with smoke. You smell just like smoke. Your clothes, to try to get the smoke out of your clothes, very difficult. You know, this is one of the trials and tribulations of even something, you know, that is considered such a sacred act. And so, and is used as an example for this, which I think is interesting. I really understood it after I sat in my first ritual. I understood what these examples were talking about. So here, when they say, all beginnings, no matter how much punya, or if they're papa, whatever it is, they all have their doshas. They're all defective. For one thing, they have a beginning, and so therefore, they have an end. That's the main point, right? They have a beginning. All of them. It doesn't matter. All karmas suffer from this defect. Because they have a beginning, they have an end. Because they are finite in nature, their results are finite in nature. You can't have a finite action produce an infinite result. And so I don't know why it takes infinite lifetimes to come to that realization. Yeah, but it does. A finite action, which is the nature of all karma, it has a beginning and it has an end, and therefore its effects have a beginning and have an end. And we notice that over and over and over in many, many different ways. Like, for instance, let me just give you a few of them. You want something so badly, you work for it, you work for it, you work for it, you go through all kinds of obstructions and obstacles, but finally you get it, you achieve it, and you are so happy to have gotten it. Okay? You're so happy to have that achievement, but at least by the next day, it just becomes a matter of course. Because now you have that. Now it's just part of your life. And so the tremendous rush of ananda that you had quickly goes away because it's been integrated into your life and now you have that and now your mind is still seeking. That's one thing we notice. Another thing we noticed, kind of in hindsight, when you're giving one of your garage sales, so many of the items in your garage sale were things that were once of great value to you. You know? It's just how it is. People who were once your enemies become your friend. People who were your friends become your enemies. You know, or they become neutral. Or neutral people who you had kind of dismissed. At another time, you realize that's really a wonderful person. And then you think back on how you just dismissed that person. They meant nothing to you, you know? In fact, you brush them off. And then you discover that there's a jewel there, you know? All of these things go on happening. So they go on happening not because there's something wrong with you. They go on happening because that's the nature of karma. There is nothing that's stationary in this world. And so everything is in a continual change. And so what he's saying here is, this is the way of it. Just because things are like that doesn't mean that you should abandon everything. Say you decide, okay, karmas themselves are useless. I really can't gain anything of lasting, you know, anything lasting from all of these karmas. And so therefore, I'm going to give up my karmas. This is what Arjuna was thinking. That's why Krishna said, I'm going to give it all up. I'm giving up all my karmas. I'm giving up. No more karmas. Okay. No more karmas. So he says, even though it's true that they all have this defect, one shouldn't give them, you shouldn't give them up. They're not to be abandoned, he says. He says, because all karmas, you give them up, these up and replace them with others, but no, those have the same problem. There's nothing you can replace them with because they're all the same in the terms of being time-bound. So this idea of giving up your karmas is not going to really, really work because they all contain the same dosha. And then there's the next problem of, how can I give up my karmas? Can I stop breathing? Should I stop walking? Should I stop talking? Should I stop going to the faucet to get a drink of water? All of these are karmas. In fact, there's no possibility of stopping doing karma. And so the whole concept is wrong. There's a fault in the whole concept. There's a couple of concepts. First of all, you can't stop doing karma because you're a karma machine. Oops. You know what? I think I forgot to start this. I forgot this to do this. So it goes.
Start what?
I didn't start the tape. Did you? Oh, okay.
I did too.
Are you there? Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I forgot to turn this airplane thing on. Okay, we're okay.
So we're a runoff.
Huh?
We're a karmic runoff.
Yeah. Anyway, so one of the main ideas here that Krishna is trying to say is all karmas, whether they're producing punya or papa, whatever the karma may be, all of them suffer from the same dosha, and none of them being time bound. And the other thing is, none of them are going to give you what you're seeking. First of all, the results are time bound. But they don't give you what you're seeking. You know? They don't give you moksha. They don't give you liberation. They don't give you liberation because they can't. They can only give you limited results. The only thing that we can really give you moksha is knowledge, is self-knowledge. And so therefore, what we need to learn is how to be with our karmas that are given to us. It's not like you can live in this world without karmas and without duties, without responsibilities. So now the question is how to be in the world and do our duties in such a way that brings about what we call antakarana shuddhi, that brings about a quietude of mind, a shanti, a peacefulness of mind that can avail itself to this knowledge. Because in the end, the moksha itself is already an accomplished fact. It's already the nature of your own being. You know? So your being is already here. The problem is not with yourself. The problem is with the mind that has beginningless ignorance. Right? Because it doesn't know yourself, the buddhi, the mind doesn't know yourself. It's suffering from beginningless ignorance, which itself has caused all kinds of problems, and trying to satisfy myself by fulfilling this, by acquiring this or acquiring that through this karma or that karma or that karma. I'm trying to acquire a collection of things, a little world for myself where I can say, I am now happy and full and complete. And that's a losing battle because all of the acquirements we get bored of. You know, all of the things that made us happy at one moment, at another moment we're indifferent to, or another moment we hate it. I hate that thing. Why the hell could I have ever gotten that thing? Now I'm stuck with it. or you say something like, how did I ever marry that guy? How did that ever happen? You know? What a mess we're in now. What were we thinking? You know? What were we thinking? It's ridiculous. So how to get out of these transitory emotional states that we're trying to have people provide for us we're trying to have people provide for us a stable emotional state, you know, or situation. Let me have this situation to give me a stable emotional state where I can say, now I am happy, all is well with me. Or I want my partner to give me a stable emotional state, you know. That's why I married you, to give me a stable emotional state. So now I can say, now I'm taking care of everything, is fine. And none of it works. So now, how can we be in the world with all of these karmas that are not going to go away? It doesn't matter whether you take sannyasa. Take sannyasa, take the orange and live the life of renunciate, or you stay in the world as a samsari. It makes no difference. The activities are not going to do it for you. They're not what's going to make the difference. There are certain attitudes toward the karmas that you do that can actually bring about what we call antakarana shuddhi, a relative shanti of your mind. And that relative shanti, you know, can then allow your mind, make your mind available to this, for this knowledge. That's the thing. That's the whole thing. Otherwise, just if your mind is hurt or agitated, or you know, you want this, you want that, and this teaching is taking place, there's nobody home. If there's some antakarana shuddhi, then your mind is available. You know. But even to want that antakarana shuddhi, you have to have been someone who's realized the natural dosha of karma itself. That karma has its own dosha, its own defect, that nothing can take away. It's its swabhava. You have to recognize the swabhava, the nature of karma. Its very nature that nobody can change. You can't, if that's what a thing is, that's what it is. The karma produces, itself is limited. It has a beginning and an end, and therefore its result has a beginning and an end. There is no such thing as a karma, which itself is time-bound, producing an infinite or changeless result. It's not possible. And so once we realize it, then you say, well, how can I get that? And if we just, how can I become a person who is whole and complete in spite of the world? We're not asking for the... No, I don't think any of us... You'd have to be not well. But none of us are asking that all of a sudden the world is just going to be made just for us to make us happy. We know that. That's not going to happen. But we would like to be whole and complete, and who I am, who I'm meant to be, in the face of the ups and downs of the world. I would like to be free, my own being, the wholeness of my own being. I would like it to be stable and untouched by the ups and downs of the world. And so for that, we can have an attitude initially that we call karma yoga. For a mumukshu has realized this, you know. We can understand attitudes that bring about for me a relative shanti, so that my mind is available for recognizing that which is free and absolute. But my mind first has to have that relative shanti in order to be able to hear. That sometimes when we're talking about antakarana shuddhi, purity of mind, if you've heard this in English, or you have to have a pure mind and all this, that also becomes an unattainable state. It's one of those words like enlightenment. When we hear it, it's such a loaded word. You know, if we say you have to have a pure mind, then you think of some sort of a saint. I have to become a saint that has a pure mind. You know, and that's something too far away. I don't even know what it really means. It's too far away. Just like enlightenment is too far away, that's meant for somebody else. Having a pure mind is too far away, it's meant for somebody else. That actually isn't true. It's having a relative shanti that is gained by your own viveka, by your own discrimination and your own understanding, you know, of Ishwara, or your own understanding of karma, of being taught how to be in this world in such a way that the mind gains a certain amount of freedom. It's a very simple thing. It's not a hard thing. What makes it hard is that we don't think about that. Mm. We don't seek that. It doesn't come across our mind. But once you ask the question that I would like to know how to do that, then the answer is there. And the answer is not very hard. That's what's so amazing. But first you have to think, you have to recognize the problem, and then wonder, how really can I be free? How can I be whole? How can I be complete? And then how can I be in this world in such a way, as somebody who's a mumukshu, a seeker, how can I be in this world in such a way that I can make use of all of these karmas that are here for me to be done, that I can make use of them properly, the proper attitude, so that my mind enjoys freedom. Even as a karta, even as long as I'm taking myself as a doer, how can I be with these... There she is. Titty's been gone all day.
Oh, Titty.
Oh, hi. Come on. How can I be with all these karmas, you know, in such a way to get that antakarana shuddhi and to gain this knowledge? So now what we're going to be doing, starting next week, we're going into this very last section, the last section of this Gita, where it's really just talking about that antakarana shuddhi and jnanam, what that all means. So they're done going through all of the varnas and, you know, the caste system and all of this. Just finished that now. And now it's going into another beautiful final section. Let's stop here.
Are you going to print out the
Yes. Hmm? That's a good question. What? We hit the last page just at the start.
Oh, yeah, I have another one. I actually passed it out to some people, but I haven't. Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. I've got to dupe someone.
Okay, I'll put it on the table now, the next section. Okay. Let's take a moment. Om Swasti Prajapya Paripalintam Nyayena Margena Mahim Mahishaha Go Brahmane Vyashubamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Pavantu Kale Varshatu Parajanyaha Prativi Sasya Shalini Desho Yam Kshobarahitaha Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kaschit dukkha bhak bhavet Asato ma sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityorma amritam gamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha. Harihi Om.
I have a question about if there's no karma that can lead to liberation, but knowledge can lead to liberation, and you have to perform karma to obtain knowledge. It seems kind of contradictory.
You don't really have to perform karma to obtain knowledge at all. But the mind, you know, the shanti of the mind has to do with really attitude. Right, and so you can do your karma, the karmas that... there's no way of not doing karma as long as you have this body, right? So you're going to be doing karma. So it's better to do the karmas that are yours, that are here in your prarabdha karma, to do those karmas, but to do them with a certain attitude. And actually that attitude is really born of knowledge. So the way that we're going to be acting in the world is a way that is actually true to my knowledge, even though that knowledge has not really arisen yet. You still have doership. But, like for instance, if I understand this as my prarabdha karma, and I understand dharma, then my commitment is to do my dharma in... do my dharma in every situation. I do it as my dharma. The dharma comes first. You may be doing things, your likes and dislikes, you may be doing things you want to do. There's no problem at all as long as dharma comes first. And then I learn how to really not have my primary motivation to my actions be the karma pala, you know, the fruit of the action. In other words, I know what I want to get out of the action, but if I don't get it, I can accept that also. So I take the result of my actions as prasad, for that prasada buddhi. The whole karma yoga is being taught is in terms of how to be in the world and how what attitude do I do my actions, because there's no not doing your actions as long as you have a body. So then with what attitude do I do them? That's karma yoga. So it's not to say, that's not correct to say that you gain moksha through knowledge, but then you have to do actions also. The actions that you're doing, or the attitude, the actions that you're doing should be in keeping with dharma. You shouldn't do the action if it's not in keeping with dharma. That's attitude again, it's knowledge again. But those actions are creating shanti in your mind. And your mind is the one that needs to gain knowledge. And here the knowledge that you're gaining is the knowledge of the self that's illumining the mind. And so that self is already present. That's one thing to gain knowledge of objects out here. That's different. The mind, the mind has to line up through the sense organs to gain a vritti, a thought modification of the object that you want to know, and then the self illumines that. And so it can be a muddy, agitated mind that is gaining knowledge of this object out here. But it's very hard for that muddy, agitated mind to recognize the very nature of the being that's illumining it. Because the muddiness, or the depression, or the agitation of the mind is what is filtering the experience of the self that's illumining it, which is samsara anyway. I mean, that's our normal experience. But we want the mind to be able to have a certain amount of shanti so it's free to recognize the nature of the me that is always present as the self of all of those experiences. Once you know yourself, it doesn't really matter if the mind is muddy or clear or agitated or what the perceptions are, because nothing's really covering you at all. But the thing is, when the mind is upset or hurt, and then the mind is trying to recognize yourself, it has not yet been able to do that viveka, that discrimination between the subject and the object. And so it's much easier if your mind, you can bring your mind to some clarity, and that's the antakarana shuddhi. So just a clear mind. Does that make sense, or are you still confused?
But if I don't come to the teacher, mm-hmm. I won't have knowledge, and coming here is an action.
You have to come here, that's an action. You have to sit down,
right.
That's an action. Right, and you have to line up your sense organs, that's an action. But now, yeah, so all these actions have to be done to get yourself in the position to gain knowledge. But the knowledge that you're gaining is not an action. You do have to set yourself up for it.
Okay, I'm okay.
I'm going to drive over here. But see, the thing is, why it's not an action is this, when the knowledge is taking place, the subject and the object are already present. Everything's already there. There is no action involved. But you do have to get yourself here. And you have to tune you have to make your sense organs present, you know. But if the object of knowledge is here, you're here, your mind is available to that sense, to the sense organs, you can't stop it. Like Swamiji sometimes gives the example of, okay, there's that painting over there, and I have my eyes are open and my mind is utilizing my eyes. Now try not to see the painting. You can't do it. Right? So knowledge takes place. If the means of knowledge, subject is there, the object of knowledge is there, and the means of knowledge is there, and your mind's not daydreaming, then knowledge will take place. There's no action involved. But you do have to set yourself up. That can take some discipline, too. I'm so tired, I'm not going to go tonight. Whatever we do. Like you can say, I'm so tired, I just can't make it to class tonight. I would
have thought But you know, this Krishna seems to be criticizing Arjuna for wanting to leave. And
he's not criticizing exactly. He's teaching him.
Teaching him, yeah.
Because Arjuna asked Krishna over and over, you know, what do you think? He says in many different ways throughout the whole Gita, because this is what Krishna's trying to. The whole teaching of the Gita. What is really the best way for me to gain moksha? Don't you think that I should go go to the Himalayas, into the forest, renounce everything, go into the forest? Don't you really think that should be the best way? So he keeps asking over and over. And so Krishna keeps telling him.
But people do take sannyas as a lifestyle.
Yes, and the thing is, what the whole Gita is saying, there's two lifestyles, basically, for a seeker. This is for a seeker. There are two lifestyles. Karma Yoga, where you stay in the world, you expose yourself to this teaching, and you work out your raga dveshas, your likes and dislikes here, in this world, in this field of experience, where you are situated. Or you take sannyasa, you take the orange, you know, you take those vows, and then you live, you say you go, in those days, you go to the Himalayas, and you live the life of a sadhu, and you spend your time studying, teaching, and meditating, and satsang. That's the dharma. That is the dharma for a sannyasi. You can't go and get a job, you know, and you can't go out to restaurants and all of these type of things that we do to entertain. That is not the dharma of a sannyasi. Your dharma is to meditate, to teach, to study, to live a contemplative life. Okay? So, and that's a very beautiful life when you're ready for it. But say you still have all of your likes and dislikes and preferences and the things that you like to do, you know, and those are still have some meaning for you, and then you think, well, if I could just transplant myself over here, you know, into the forest, then all of these habits and needs and everything will be done with, because I will have left them. And Krishna says, you don't leave them, you take them with you. And now you've got a bundle there. And then they give the example, you know, of such a person sitting under the tree meditating, because that's your dharma as a sannyasi, to contemplate and to really own this knowledge and to teach. You're sitting there meditating, thinking about all of the things, meditating on all of the things that he'd left behind. Right? And that would be natural, because those things had not been outgrown. So it's better to stay in the world and view the world as a karma yogi, which he spent so much time in the Gita teaching, with these particular attitudes that allow the raga dveshas, your likes and dislikes, you know, the real likes and dislikes. I need this so that I can be happy. I need this so that I can be happy. So those become like dagda bijas, means burnt seeds. I want them, but if I don't get them, I'm fine. Really, my commitment becomes more and more to just doing what is helpful in this moment. Here's the situation. How can I be helpful in this moment. You know, I look at the whole thing as Ishvara, as with that prasada buddhi. So I have to understand that. I mean, I'm just saying a few words about it now, but really the Gita has gone on and on explaining what exactly this means. So I have to understand it and appreciate it, and that's actually how I live my life. Because what I am seeking is moksha. Oh, what if I'm seeking other things? Moksha is not important to me. I'm seeking other things. Then if you're a Vaidika, if you're part of that culture, or Dharma Nishtha, then Dharma is still the most important to you. And dharmically, you go after your raga dvesha, your likes and dislikes. But what you want are whatever the results of your karma. You want to achieve this and you want to achieve that, but as a good person, you're a dharmic person, you go after those things following Dharma. And if you do that, then eventually your mind has some shanti anyway, because you're doing Dharma even though you're going after your raga dvesha. But you will have the inner space to at some point realize the limitations of karma itself. Because you follow Dharma, you have an inner space. That inner space allows for that self-reflection. So that will eventually lead to that mumukshutvam, where you ask, what is really my way out in terms of becoming like a whole, complete person? Because you realize the limitations of karma, that you really can't get what you're ultimately looking for. And then you become a mumukshu, somebody who desires liberation.
Well, you know, a lot of times you do search for this well-being, and it's just a...
it's an illusion.
It's so evasive.
It is evasive. That's what turns you into a mumukshu. Because at some point you say, it is evasive, and it's evasive by the very nature of the creation. It's not evasive because I can't find it. It's evasive because it can't be found. It's a big difference. You know, and then I become somebody who's a seeker and want to know, is there a solution to this problem? For a while, you know, some people think they're a failure because they're not making this whole thing work.
Yeah.
You know, to their satisfaction. It's a very frustrating. I think people who are very wealthy have a really hard time with it, because now they have all the material goods, all of the wealth, everything. And oops.
No payoff?
Now what? Now what? So a lot of times going after more power, you become some more dharmic people will go more into philanthropy. But whatever it is, that's why they say whether it's punya or papa, whatever it is, it's limited. So you can't get that completion, because you're looking for it where it isn't. That's the reason. You already are complete, but you're looking for it out here.
To say it in a, I guess, maybe a little bit different way,
mm-hmm.
I don't actually gain moksha. It's my mind that gains moksha.
Yeah, the self's already, yeah, absolutely. The self's already free.
It's the knowledge that's just giving... The knowledge, the recognition of the mind, of the knowledge, which gives the mind peace.
I'll say that again.
The knowledge, once it's recognized by the mind, is what gives the mind peace.
That's true. There's two things. One is the recognition of yourself, which is self-evident, so it doesn't even need the mind.
Right.
But now but the ignorance has been removed, so that... there's this yourself, which is free by nature.
Right.
Okay. And then there's also the mind's recognition of that takes away all of the tension of the mind.
Right.
Yeah. Because that's what the mind has been seeking. And now it's discovered that what it was seeking is the very nature of the seeker, which is the very nature of its being. We're saying the same thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
That's where the peace
for the mind comes from.
That's right. But it's twofold. There's, well, why I keep saying a little differently than you, because it's a language thing. There is what we call the absolute shanti, paramartika shanti, which is always there, even when the mind is agitated. It's not covered for some of you. But the pola for the, so there's two polas, two fruits. One is the recognition of that absolute shanti, which no matter what the mind does, is ever present. So shanti is there present to the ashanti. Okay. And then the secondary pola is that the mind, because it's discovered what it's always been searching for, its problems are resolved because nobody can take that self away. And so now the mind has fulfilled itself. And so it has its shanti.
And then you can go ahead with actions.
Yeah, live your life.
And
because
as you said, like the seeds are burnt.
Yes. They're all burnt seeds because they don't produce. You may want something, but if you don't get it, it's fine. I want to do this, I'd like to do this. I mean, you know why you're doing something, right? You're doing something, you get a result, but if it doesn't work out for some reason, well, that's fine. I can try again in another way or give it up and do something else. It doesn't matter. I'm not broken by the so-called failures. I mean, we don't even call them failures. It's just this thing's not working out. It's all right. Because my wholeness is not at all changed or dependent.
Can you tell a little bit about having an agitated mind and still having peace illuminating, an absolute peace illuminating this agitated, crazy mind kind of thing?
You know, one there's the recognition of that before it becomes habitual. Mm-hmm. Because actually yourself, the luminary, the one, the conscious being, the me that is illumining the mind, is always only illumining the mind. It's never changed in any way. Mm-hmm. And so that peace is absolute, you know. But the mind, until that viveka, that discrimination between my own nature and whatever is going on in the mind, whatever moods or emotions or whatever are going on, the mind is always overwhelming the buddhi, the intellect. It's always overwhelming with its worries and agitations and fears and all this. So that's why we did this meditation, you know, with this question in mind. You get used to waking up when you're lost in your worry or lost in your agitation. You wake, the buddhi wakes up, I bring the mind home to my own presence, or the buddhi wakes up to the situation. And if the buddhi wakes up to the situation instead of being overwhelmed, then it can do something. Then the buddhi, almost as the voice of your being, can say something like, "You're worrying, tell me what's going on there." Subject object. Uh-huh. The worry becomes objectified and you say, tell me about it, what's happening. Or say the mind, the manas is distraught and despairing. The buddhi wakes up and it says, or comes onto the scene, you know, and instead of being as though overshadowed, overwhelmed by the emotion, then it says, you know, you're really feeling so much sorrow. Tell me what's that's really about. Let me help.
A cloudy day.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a cloudy day. Tell me. Yeah. But bringing that buddhi into the situation, that's why I say inner friend. Inner friend just really means it's a voice for your own nature. That makes so much difference.
So when you're running around in these emotional trips and freakouts, the point is that you have in fact identified with that problem, and then when you wake up to it, you're realizing, hey, I'm not that. You're objectifying it.
You're right. So the thing is,
discrimination just. That's the beginning of you being able to fix the problem because
right there, and it only takes
broken right then.
Yeah, and it's less than a split second. Then you become now your buddhi has objectified the problem instead of being overwhelmed by it, and then it can say something. This inner friend is so important, where that inner friend is the one who wants to help the situation. Otherwise, the buddhi, it's still overwhelmed by some interject, like the negative father interject. And then say the buddhi comes awake to the problem, but the one who is still overwhelming the buddhi is the negative father interject that then says, you know, what the hell are you doing? That was how my father talked.
Sounds familiar. Yeah.
What do you think you're doing here? You know, then if you see that, then you have to say something like, no, that's how your father used to talk to you. That's not me. You're just acting out what your dad used to say to you. The one who comes in as the buddhi has to have be the inner friend. That's a voice for yourself. The self is so benign, so free of any kind of fear. It has no fear, and you have no fear of it. That's the one who has to be talking.
And some of these affects can come in as not so much as a scolding father, but as a wave of moods.
I know, but then that's what you address.
Yeah.
Then the buddhi says, "You're feeling so sad," or "How can I help?" You know, something. So that's offering some sort of love. Love is the magic word, really. You have to... We all just want to be loved. And all the complexes inside and all the hurts inside, they just want to feel loved. And so I'm just saying loved and respected. You know? I can love you and act like you're an imbecile. You know? Or I love you and I respect you. I respect you for who you are. Even little babies, you know, in India, they're very good at that. They have so much respect for their little ones. So much love and so much respect. And you see these little ones walking around as little people. You know? You see that? They're little important little people. You have, you know, every right to be and have their thoughts and their opinions, and they're so centered. But that's really because the parents look at them like that. And it's really wonderful. So sweet. Yeah, I used to just love that. Because Swamiji, you know, this was in the 70s, there were always Indian families coming with their children. And I used to just be amazed to watch these kids and how well-formed, like, the little entities they were. Real little kids. 2, 3, 4. Yeah. So sweet.
They're peaceful.
Mm-hmm. I still remember this one over there, very, very close to Swamiji. It's one woman, her name is Vidya, and her husband. She had two little girls, and they were only like 9 or 10 months apart. And they used to follow her around like little ducklings. She was the mama duck. And these little ducklings were always right by her side, you know, right next to her. Wherever she went, the little ducklings would be going along with her. It was the cutest thing. So sweet.
You'd love a dog. Huh? You'd love to have a dog. They do that.
Yeah. I can't wait to have a dog. And Tibby has to love the dog. That's going to be something. We'll see.
It's a very good point to respect.
Respect,
yeah. I think our parents in the West often, in the name of love, they don't include respect.
Yeah. And also they're worn out.
Yeah.
It's another problem, you know. They used to, even in our Western countries, they used to have, you know, a extended family. And so the children were taken care of by the aunts and uncles and grandparents. And so they got lots of love, lots of holding, and the parents could go and do what they needed to do, and there were plenty of people to take care of the kids. It's much different when two, mother and father, are supposed to take care of the 2, 3, 4 kids and work and do everything else and no support. So it's
broken.
hard, very hard. They're exhausted. I know that from, you know, not from some of my own family members, but also from some of my patients in my practice. Really wonderful people, you know, and mothers who really love their children. They're just exhausted, though, exhausted, and so hard to figure out a way to handle that. They don't have the infrastructure to help them. So everybody online and all of us, I won't be here on Saturday. I'm going to send out a maiden now. I'm going to need to be at the farm. So Saturday, we won't have Saturday class.
Not Sunday.
Well, Sunday online. I'll be at the farm on Sunday. Yeah. We will have class online. But we won't have Saturday class at all. So let me send out tonight I'll send out a mailing. I didn't send it out yet because I wasn't sure until this later on this evening that I could go. So,
I wish you'd had a photograph of the little ducklings.
I know. My little ducklings. So sweet little girls. Now they're sweet adults. Yeah. They're all grown up.
Yeah. What a coincidence.
Yeah. Yes. Okay.